Accession number 20459, reel 16.
Captain Spencer, reel 16. I was asking you if the call to Malaya came before or after the course at Bracken.
The call to Bracken came before I had this invitation to go or posting to Malaya.
How long did the Brecon course last?
I say about 2 days, no more. I think it, as you say, it was more of an assessment than a training performance. I'd also forgot to mention now that by this time the war in Europe had ceased. So I've been celebrating the war, the VE Day, which is why the suggestion going out to Malaya came after this particular time.
Who else was on that course, the Brecon course?
Well, I can't give you... I mean, it was a very short space of time, but there were mostly officers of my own age group. They were from a whole variety of types of regiments and services, including, strangely enough, the one person who wasn't in army uniform at all. I didn't have a chance to talk to him, but where he took place, or whether he was sort of one of the behind-the-lines people who had been dropped into Europe or was going to go into somewhere else. The training course took place, the assessment course took place before the end of the war in Europe, which is why the things then changed later.
How many people were there in Brecon when you did this two-day test, do you think?
Well, I was saying that there were about 20 officers and 15 other ranks there at the time, and a staff of probably about 15 to 20 as well. We were all in Nissen huts, out into a very out-of-the-way location in the country.
You did the assault course. You had the interview with the psychiatrist. Can you remember what other things you did in that 2 days?
Yes, basically, that again, we had lectures in terms of assessing movement in countries. A lot of it was, I felt, inappropriate for me because I was certainly not a language expert in the sense that I couldn't absorb myself into a country. And a lot of it was orientated to assuming that you would mix with whatever population or whatever country you were. So a lot of this was a question of being careful that you didn't say thank you or good evening or whatever it was. You had to keep purposely alert. So a lot of it was to do with sort of rather like MI16 or whatever they call work, rather than just purely assault troops. So really, I can't give much more than that. I can't really think of any other particular techniques or whatsoever they used.
So you got notification you were going out to the Far East. What happened after that? Were you left?
Well, my parents obviously weren't too happy, having sort of survived prisoner of war and everything else. They weren't too keen that I was going to sort of put myself in further danger. But I reported to a staging camp somewhere near Bracknell, and we went to, I think, from I can't remember which airport we flew, but we flew in Dakotas, in three Dakotas took off, in actual fact. And while we were flying over France, which we could do then, one of the planes that I could see out of the window had smoke coming from one of its engines. It didn't look as if it was a disaster, but obviously it then started to descend somewhere to land in France. We We landed at Karachi, and there for a night, and there were a number of people in the plane who were either joining regiments or in various throughout Pune, but nobody else going to where I was going to go to Madras, where there was a training course apparently organized. So we went to Pune, which I found very interesting, in a truck. And we went to continue to Delhi, dropping people off at various stages. We were maybe a couple of in Delhi, and we then took a train to Bombay, where I went into the first air-conditioned restaurant, which I'd never met before. So it was nice to spend most of the day there rather than outside. And we then took a train to Madras, where I was billeted in a fairly large house with a number of servants in it. It obviously, having not been to this part of the world before, I was entranced and appalled by the tremendous difference of living status in terms of the absolute terrible poverty and the luxury of the local hotels with the swimming pools and being waited on hand and foot and everything else. The training as such was not too intense. It was sort of a number of few hours a day, and we were learning to make falls from a parachute. We did a couple of descents from a tower, but I never, unfortunately, had a chance of actually making a parachute drop, which I would have liked to have said that I've done.
When you came down from the tower, was this on a sort of sling?
Yes, you came on a parachute, but it was attached, so you had rather like free fall.
Yes.
But from a tower, but the chute was controlled, so you rolled off it.
Yeah.
And you did various other, a lot of physical work there. Plus, at this stage, we were being briefed on Malaya itself and the traditions of the people in it, and we were to question which location we were going to. I was going to go somewhere into the hills in Kualatan, I think it was, north of Seremban anyway. I can't remember precisely where we were going. But this wasn't for very, very many days. One of the incidences I remember is that there was a Sikh officer who I met in the house we were billeted in, who was ex-Sandhurst also. He sounded if he was ex-Eton. He was either Eton or Harrow or somewhere of that kind. And we became very good friends, a very charming man. But on one occasion when we were in a jeep and speeding through a village out in the country, an old man wandered into the road and he hit him and then drove on. And I said, oh, he's only an untouchable. I said, you bloody well stop. And we're going back. He said, oh, it might be dangerous. I said, don't mind. And so that absolutely astonished me. In other words, so perfectly normal and nice. I couldn't understand anybody hitting somebody and not worrying about it. But of course, I've since learned this attitude is very prevalent out there. You know that they have very little disregard for this sort of thing. So anyway, we went back there. The man was not seriously injured. I'm not quite sure he didn't, but anyway, that there was we were convinced that he was going to be properly looked after, and there wasn't any trouble of anybody shouting at us or anything else. So, but that was an insight into the general approach. The begging in the streets and people dragging themselves out on stumps and this, that, and the other, I found to be very disturbing, and I said to myself, it's somewhere I couldn't live and work in those sort of circumstances when there's such a diversity of poverty. Very soon afterwards, we heard that the bomb had been dropped, and war was virtually over.
What did you think when you heard that news? What was your first reaction?
My first reaction was, you know, was thank goodness for that. My second reason, thank Baltimore for that, because I was suddenly thinking that to drop into malaria again, I was thinking perhaps I was not so sensible after all. And so I think I had a great moment of relief that though I committed myself to do this particular thing and was initially quite keen to do something, I think I was more than, and not only that, you're obviously relieved that, that in spite of, not that we knew the amount of casualties at that stage or the enormity of the situation, but that, I mean, the mere fact that the slaughtering was stopped was a matter of tremendous relation, and also so everybody else. The one or two people who hadn't been involved in the war at all were a little disappointed that they weren't going to be involved. But we weren't a collective unit. We weren't a unit. So, I mean, it was part of 136. But we were going to go to different parts at different times.
What was your mission going to be when you were...
Well, our mission was going to be was that we were going to join units already stationed, already planted in, that had established guerrilla networks or so and so. And the idea was to go in to either cut the road or network or so, depending what's in. But basically, to ensure that there wasn't a collapse of the general administration. We were able to take over the office and so forth and so on, depending on what the situation was. But that was the idea, was to secure certain vital buildings or bridges or roads or so, that we weren't doing the demolition work ourselves, although we did a little demonstration of demo, but those people, personnel, were there. So to a certain extent, I was in a semi-organizing capacity to assess the situation on the ground when we got there. But as I say, this didn't happen. So we went in by boat to Singapore, and very quickly entrained for myself surrender. At this time, of course, that so soon after the collapse, the prisoners of war were coming back, and I must say that I've never seen such terrible sights. People, you couldn't see an ounce of flesh on them. I mean, their sunken stomachs, faces, heads, and everything else. So that was really quite a sight.
Did you see anything of the Japanese troops?
Yes, well, that quite a lot.
What did you make of them?
Well, there were a couple of stories on that, to jump ahead a bit. When I was in Seremban, when I was in Tampin, I was looking after a camp of Japanese. And they would appear to have robbed, I had some drink and clothes stolen from my house. And the trail led to their camp of discarded stuff. They'd obviously become drunk. And I called the camp commandant, and I said, I want the people responsible for this found, and we will decide what the punishment is. 2 days later, I was asked to go and what name, and the whole camp was on parade. And I was told that they had found the two culprits, and they were told to step forward in the ring. And then four other Japanese soldiers came forward with batons and started beating them. And I said, stop. And I said, well, you know, we'll decide what punishment should be done. He said, well, you know, they've disgraced our first, they're second, and they'll do it. So I said, well, who gave this order? So he said, oh, well, the officer there. So he shouted out. The next moment, I found them battering the officer for giving the order. So I said, no, you know, we just don't do things that way at all. Anyway, that was just an illustration. But while at Seremban, of course, there were camps of Japanese, and they were being organized to bring their arms and put them in dumps. They were extremely well disciplined. Inscrutable, I think, is the word as far as their expression is concerned. But they were herded into various camps and then trained to go south, which is where when I was at Tampin, was where one of the camps had been formed for the prisoners before they were repatriated. But I can't remember any instance of trouble.
What physical condition were they in?
Fairly reasonable compared with the prisoners. That there was very little sort of spirit from them. They weren't sort of jubilant. They all looked very dejected and listless to a certain extent. But luckily, most of them were dispensed quickly, and I was became the billeting officer in Seremban, and was living in a fairly palatial house there. And I met for the first time James Calder, who featured in the various things at the time. And one particular instance I remember quite well was that we had commandeered a number of houses in the particular area, and people coming up for various administrative jobs and everything else. I'll just show you in a moment the house that were there. But I got a phone call at about 3 a.m. that somebody had arrived at the station and wanted accommodation. And I thought, well, it's a bit much to ring one of the other, wake somebody up. So I got up and got my jeep out and went to collect him and put him in one of the spare rooms in the residency.
Is that it there? Yeah. Yes.
But the governor, the commissioner, the resident commissioner, who was James Calder, who was very tubby, ungainly chap, waddled down the corridor and said, "What the bloody hell do you think's going on here?" And I said, "Well, explain the situation." He said, "Not bloody well staying here. Get him out immediately." I said, "But he said, don't butt me. Get him out." I said, "Look, I'm sorry, you know, so-and-so." So I had to then rouse somebody else and take him out. So I wasn't very pleased about that. And the relationship with Calder was a very strange one, really. But a fellow called Air Chief Marshal Longmore,
yes,
was actually staying at the residence at the same time, coming over on a diplomatic mission of some kind. So when I went down for breakfast, he was already at the breakfast table. Calder came down, and I immediately attacked him and said, "You know, that is one of the most, you know, despicable things I think you've done." And he started shouting. I said, "No, you know, I mean, what the bloody hell difference did it make that he stayed the bloody night?" I said, "I didn't want to make a fuss in front of him, but I mean, you know, that really was what's." I saw our chief marshal looking at it. Anyway, we ended up shouting at each other, the rest of the commission myself, and he got up from the table and left. And our chief marshal said, "I've never heard such a disgraceful performance. Don't you realise you were speaking to a senior officer?" And I said, "Yes, I do." But I said, "But if somebody has behaved badly, And what's he going to do? To shoot me or something, you see? Anyway, he gradually, he said, you're an extraordinary fellow. He said, you know, it does seem unreasonable, but surely, you know, you ought to have been more, wasn't I? I said, yes, I probably should have been, but there we are. Anyway, that was a particular instance of the man. But then there was quite a lot of work to do, in the sense that...
I was going to ask you what your role was when you got to Saranban, what you were supposed to be
my
doing.
My principal
there.
Role was as ADC.
To this man Calder.
To this man Calder.
And he was
which
a civilian.
Is a really, he was the resident commissioner.
Mm. Was he a colonial office man?
He was a colonial, he was a colonel then.
Yes.
But he was an ex-colonial official.
Yes.
And not an army man at all.
Mm.
And therefore he is well versed in general running of a state. I mean, at that particular time we were checking up on the number of the courts that were still there, the question of the hospital and their supplies, the condition of the railways, who are the railway officials. So there was an awful lot of research and administration work to do, is to make sure that everything was starting to function again. What's the name? I mean, the banks. One of the things they were changing the currency. One of the people there I knew had sort of been buying the Japanese dollars that I've got here, and filling a house with them. But of course, then overnight, they were deployed absolutely null and void. Which, of course, caused a certain amount of consternation in the one time. But so I found this an extremely interesting time, in the sense of having very quickly transferred from the army and thinking of dropping in and fighting, and then getting involved into the administration. They formed an organization called the British Military Administration, which I then became part of, and became extremely interested, because you felt you're really doing something of interest. I mean, I was sent out to various areas to check up on what the chieftains there and everything else.
What were the main priorities as far as the restoration of normal conditions was concerned?
The main priority, basically, was to make sure the railway, the roads were clear, and then that the hospitals were equipped, had staff. So I think really the priorities were the general administration, and then the hospitals. Certainly the courts, but there's quite a lot more came up in the courts, and who the officials were, how many, because, I mean, these were all courts run under the Japanese. So I wasn't there for too long, and then I...
Had there been active collaboration with the Japanese in that state?
Oh, most certainly. There was every evidence that there was what's his name. But I was then posted to an area called Tampin, to Rembao, where I became the assistant district officer of Rembao.
Yes.
And again found myself involved in a less large scheme, but certainly travelling throughout the whole of that area to look at the chieftain of what's taken place and so forth. I hadn't got the same capacity, but again, the question of rice distribution.
I just want to ask you if you were concerned with the availability of food. And
yes, well, certainly I was, but then very shortly after that, a fellow called John Eaton, who was the district officer of Tampin, was going home. And I took over his dog, called Catru, and the administration of the area there, of Tampin, which was about 600 square miles. The offices in which I occupied still had tufts of hair, bloody hair, and where people had been smashed against the wall all the way around. They still hadn't been cleaned up. The staff, who I've got photographs, were the same staff that had been there under the Japanese. And so the evidence was that the atrocities that had been committed there were unspeakable. And therefore I became not disillusioned, but fairly tough with decisions. I didn't really care too much as to the staff had to do what I wanted, and that was the end of it. I have to remember that, of course, I was still very young and not particularly well tutored in general administration.
Was there a policy then of keeping on officials and judges and staff, even if they had collaborated, or was the general idea to get rid of them and purge them?
Well, I was again finding my feet. There were a couple of points. One is that the colonial government paid various chieftains retainers over the year, and these had restarted. And the one of the where I had come from was a chap or chieftain was I'm trying to remember his name. It was a lack of form, but anyway, whoever he was local chieftain, and his word was law. And the prisoners who were in various prisons throughout the area, we had decided, the government had decided they should be released because we couldn't review their cases or anything else, and they were prisoners under the Japanese regime. And therefore, it would be fair to release the lot of them, and, you know, providing that they then behaved themselves, it was all forgiven.
General amnesty.
Yes. Now, the Undanga, that's right, the Undanga of Rembau, said, I'm sorry, that couldn't be done, because he'd sentenced these people, and his word was law, and, you know, that therefore he done it, they'd have to stay there. So we called a court meeting, and I listened for about an hour to somebody interpreting for me, because I hadn't then picked up Malay. How this fellow said, no, he couldn't do this, that, and the other. So I was getting a bit fed up. And I bore in mind that this bloke was the person who, still surviving under the Japanese, there are evidence that people had their head chops off all over the place, so he must have connived with this. I wasn't particularly friendly disposed towards him anyway. And of course, in those days, you know, you wore one, I had my revolver holster beside me. So I said, you know, call the meeting to a halt, and I asked this particular chieftain to come into a separate room. He spoke English, and I said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you're a dirty, filthy swine. I said, here you are, those people, and you're all this argument, and so you've been told to release them, and you know I can't do this. So I pulled out my revolver, and I put it in his ear, and I said, unless you go back immediately and say that all prisoners are free and that, you know, and that's the end of it, I'll blow your bloody head off. A very arbitrary decision. However, he went back and he didn't stop talking for some time. So I don't think he took too kindly to me, but I did achieve what was wanted.
Who had made the decision in the first instance that all prisoners should be
A directive from central government that has come down through from the governor.
Which the Undang was disposed to ignore.
Right. Now, there, of course, there were a lot of Chinese business, so that was one instance. I mean, it seems a very high-handed thing to do, but I was very young, and it was so close to what had happened and the evidence I'd seen. That it was a reaction. Anyway, it happened. One of the other instances was that the question of rice distribution, which is